Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And man, this is going to be too much like a time warp back to 10 years ago. I got Dar Jamail on the phone. Luckily, he's not in Iraq. He's in Qatar and reporting for Truthout. The latest is Iraqi government killing civilians in Fallujah. You see what I mean? About just like a long time ago. Welcome back to the show, Dar. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Very good to have you here. And, man, well, I guess, let us have it. Tell us your story here.
Yeah, you're right. It is, unfortunately, too much like a time warp here, except instead of the U.S. military directly attacking Fallujah, shelling people, engaging in collective punishment like not allowing medical supplies into the city, more civilians being killed than fighters. We are all too familiar with that story. I've talked with you about it on air right here. But instead of the U.S. military, it's the Maliki government and sort of to a certain extent by proxy for the U.S. military, because it's the U.S. government that's been rushing arms to Maliki to use against the people in Fallujah since this crisis took a turn to the much more violent just starting this past January. But that's essentially what's happened. I mean, overall, we had a situation where the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, a small contingent of them moved into the city and started fighting against Maliki's government forces there alongside people inside the city, more generalized resistance forces that have been taking up arms against the Maliki government as a result of failed demands being met. We have to, let me just backtrack a little bit here first. Sure. Starting back in late 2012, I know that you're aware of this, Scott, because Annie Wars reported on this extensively as it was going on. But starting in late 2012, there started to be a massive ongoing protest every Friday, oftentimes blocking the highway that goes between Baghdad and Amman, Jordan. It runs right in front of Fallujah. So people in Anbar, and specifically in Fallujah and Ramadi, would gather there during Friday prayers to do their prayers and then have a protest against the government, because the government, they were accusing them of coming in, conducting home detentions, taking people, suspected fighters, etc., literally doing the exact same thing that the U.S. military used to do in Fallujah, simply because these people were in opposition to some of Maliki's sectarian tactics in the government in Baghdad. And so he was retaliating by targeting people in Anbar province, because that's where most of the resistance was coming from. Again, conducting home raids, bringing people into prisons, torturing people, raping people, both men and women. And this was rampant all across Anbar and parts of Baghdad where Maliki was meeting resistance as well. Again, if we just replace Maliki with U.S. forces and back up 10 years, it's basically the same story. But those protests were going on all through 2013, none of the demands being met, the situation continuing to worsen. Maliki's army started opening fire on demonstrators, killing people from time to time in various places around Anbar province, sometimes in Baghdad. And then it really hit a crescendo this past January when overt fighting broke out and resistance fighters started to open attacks on the Maliki government forces, kicking them out of Ramadi, kicking them out of Fallujah. That's when ISIS slipped in and joined the fight. And then, of course, Maliki basically started waving the terrorist flag and saying, look, once again, Al-Qaeda has taken control of Fallujah, just like when you guys were here saying this to the Obama administration. We need some more arms here pronto. So in addition to the already $20 billion of weaponry and training that the U.S. government has provided Maliki, who's basically now looked upon by many in Iraq as a Shia Saddam, they upgraded even more weapons and missiles to ship to him, to rush ship to him, to use starting this past January on the people of Fallujah. And so we have a situation now, again, resembling much what happened in 2004 that you and I talked about regarding the U.S. military. The Iraqi government has circled Fallujah. They can't get into the city, so they're shelling it on a daily basis. And once again, we have a situation where clearly the majority of the people being killed are civilians. I spoke with Dr. Ahmed Shami, the chief of resident doctors at Fallujah General Hospital, and he told me last week that up to then, and these numbers are going to be a little bit out of date now because these are about a week old, but up to that point, he said there were at least 109 civilians that had been killed and 632 that were wounded. And then of those, at least 10 of the dead were children, another 40 of the wounded were children, and then as far as women goes, at least 5 of the dead were women, and 35 of the wounded were also women.
Well, so part of this story is about the success of terrorism. It always seems to work for what we used to call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, this tiny percentage of the Sunni insurgency, the Zarqawiites. Now they call themselves the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as you said. And all they got to do is hoist the black flag, fire an AK-47 in the air a couple of times, and provoke a massive violent clampdown, or at least create the excuse, right, for the Maliki government, the Shiite Baghdad government, to clamp down and drive more people into their cause, which is, at this point now, it's much more focused on fighting Assad, I think, than fighting Maliki. They already kind of lost the war to Maliki a few years back, but they can at least provoke Maliki into driving up their recruitment as they head west. And, of course, it's good politics for Maliki, too, to say, hey, I'm the leader of the Shiites, protecting the Shiites from the Sunnis, because he wasn't going to get the Sunni votes anyway, right? To misparaphrase James Baker about F them, they don't vote for us either way, so.
That's accurate, Scott. I mean, that really is, in a nutshell, politically, the rough sketch of what's going on, and that's why we've seen these clashes from inside of Iraq bleed up to the borders with Syria, and we've seen Iraqi military guys killed up on the border of Syria by these ISIS fighters, and then that going into Syria, and we have literally Sunni fighters pouring into Syria to take on that fight, as well as then Shia militias going up into Syria as well to back the Assad regime. So we already have an intra-country war in that respect, and this is basically one facet of it. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, the tragedy of it is that, just like you said, we have a small number of these ISIS guys coming to Fallujah, literally did just as you described, raise a black flag. They were within minutes told by the tribal leaders in the city, who really are the people in control of the city, just like when the Americans were sieging it, said, look, no, that's not going to fly. You're not running the show here. Get those flags down. They were down less than 5 minutes after they were raised. They were put properly in their place, and that just shows who's in charge. But then, of course, that gives the Maliki government carte blanche, according to them anyway, to encircle the city. They're not letting any medical supplies in, according to Dr. Shami, and they've been shelling it every day since. Some of the other doctors I spoke with in there, one on condition of anonymity, and this doctor had actually had to flee the city because her neighborhood was being shelled so heavily. She said mosques were being targeted. I have a photo in the story that I wrote for Truth Out from Dr. Shami of the outside of Fallujah General Hospital. Shells have landed nearby the hospital. The hospital itself has taken shrapnel from those shellings, and you can see that in one of the photos that I posted. And this is the great tragedy. So we have a hospital, at least one main hospital has been shelled, several mosques. We have civilians being killed. The shelling continues. And to date, from Fallujah, it's an estimated 300,000 people. So the majority of the people of Fallujah have once again had to flee their city. That's about almost the exact same number that had to flee during the U.S. sieges in 2004. And then if we look at Al-Anbar province more broadly, bringing Ramadi into the mix, which isn't too far from Fallujah, there's also a lot of ongoing fighting there, and we have another approximately 100,000 people who've been displaced there. So once again, we have a massive displacement of people within Al-Anbar province. tribal leaders calling for the Maliki government to back off, just let people go home. We've got to get relief supplies in there. But once again, the Maliki government is just keeping the city encircled and continuing with the shelling. Really, at least unfortunately, as of right now, we don't see an end in sight.
Oh, man. It's such a mess. And, all right, well, when we get back from the break, we're going to, I want to backtrack a little bit to something Ray McGovern said in a speech the other day about the beginning of the war in Fallujah back 10 years ago in the spring of 2004, the first battle of Fallujah and Najaf at the same time, of course. And then the major battle of Fallujah, the one that people remember the most, was right after the election of 2004. In November there, and I seem to remember, Dar, learning from you the cause and effect, and we went down the chain and explained, you really explained on the show back years ago about how much that had played into precipitating the civil war that took hold after the election and the Constitution and the rise of the Iraq United Alliance and all that. So, anyway, more with Dar Jamail at truthout.org. When we get back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Saddam Hussein no longer fills fields with remains of innocent men, women, and children. Because we acted, Saddam's torture chambers and rape rooms and children's prisons have been closed for good.
Reopened under new management. The Dawah Party in the form of Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister of Iraq. All right, so now... we can talk all about, I want to hear all about the current casualties and any of that you want to prioritize. I'll really let you, Dar, but I was hoping I could hear from you about how, you know, the entire war was a disaster from beginning to end. Nobody would ever justify any part of it, I don't think, not anymore. But it did not have to be quite as horrible as it was. And, I remember you explaining about how the original attack on Fallujah generated so many refugees that they ended up generating more refugees where they landed, and then those refugees generated some more refugees where they ended up, and how in the lead up to the voting on the Constitution and the voting for who was going to rule the parliament and all of that, how this had really helped solidify all of the enemy sides, you know, in time for the vote to make it all that much worse, which I hope I didn't just tell the whole story. But anyway, and then also, if you could, I would have you talk about the surge and the benchmarks, which were supposed to include, the so-called victory that makes the Iraq War anything but a defeat for America somehow, is that David Petraeus saved the day. But the deal was he was supposed to integrate, Maliki was supposed to allow the Sunni tribal leaders and whoever, their political representation, into the government and have a, you know, multi-party democracy kind of thing going forward here and all of that. And, you know, how well that worked out, and especially in terms of the protest movement and the renewed civil war that you've been describing here. And now I'll be quiet and turn the mic over to you.
Well, yeah, that's a lot, Scott. I mean, there's so much there to discuss. I mean, I'll start with the point that you ended with, and then hit a couple of other things that you brought up that I think are really important to what's going on in Fallujah right now. And start with the Sawa forces, the so-called awakening forces that you were just speaking of. That the U.S. basically went in. It was part of the so-called surge in 2007. And really, in reality, what they did is that was even more important than injecting 30,000 more troops into Iraq was they reconstituted an old strategy of Saddam, which is what he used to keep things under control in Anbar province, which was find certain tribal leader sheikhs who would do business with him, basically pay them millions of dollars to get them then to distribute that money out to people under their power and control, and basically pay off their fighters to lay low and don't attack the big man in charge, and let's try to keep things fairly copacetic. That's essentially how that played out, and that's exactly what the U.S. did. They went out, they found which sheikhs would play ball with them. They started funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into them. One of these, Sheikh Affan, was a man, actually a Saudi man, who was part Iraqi, who came back in to Iraq in 2006 and basically posed as a native Fallujah man, a sheikh in power, and came in, took the U.S. money, quickly put together, cobbled together with that money, a 900-man militia under his command, bought a real nice palace on the outskirts of Fallujah, built up the walls, put a bunch of machine gun emplacements in it, and became the Sawa leader in charge of Fallujah until he was then assassinated. And that's how this has run its course, where the U.S. basically propped these guys up so that these guys would start taking more of the hit than the U.S. military was. And it was fairly effective at the time at splintering off some of the resistance movement who went with the Sawa forces, took the money, until the U.S. Left them high and dry. And then, of course, as you just said, Maliki broke his promises. Hey, we're going to take these 100,000 guys, we're going to incorporate them into the Iraqi military, we're going to give them jobs, pay them, get these folks representation within the government. None of that happened. These guys started not being paid immediately, and the U.S. left them hung out to dry. And then now what we're left with is these Sawa forces, some of them still aligning themselves with Maliki's army. A few of them have gotten jobs, the majority of still have not. Yet they still often are being targeted. And you look at anti-war, Jason Ditch's daily updates on what's going on in Iraq. Every other day you're going to see Sawa guys that are being taken out and or with their families. And that is continuing to this day. So these guys are there, and they're still being taken out. And they will be, because they're being seen by the majority of the people in the Iraqi resistance as collaborators, which for the most part the majority of them are. And that, of course, is just one level of this very complex situation as to how and why Iraq is the absolute train wreck that it is today. And then going backwards, just, quick history, something that you brought up right before the break. You mentioned Ray McGovern's talk and really talking about what got the ball rolling in Fallujah, because so many people think it's when the Blackwater guys were caught there, and the four of them were killed, and the bodies burned and hung from the bridge on March 31, 2004. But we could go back to the beginning of the invasion, but even just backing up a little over a week before that date, we can look at what happened in the Gaza Strip at the hands of the Israeli military, where on March 22, 2004, Sheikh Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, was assassinated by an Israeli missile. And that then created conditions in Fallujah where what formed up in Fallujah at the time was a Sheikh Yassin Revenge Brigade. And when the four Blackwater guys were killed on March 31st, actually I believe it was AP had reported at the time that the people who killed the Blackwater guys, who claimed responsibility, called themselves the Sheikh Yassin Revenge Brigades. And they did it out of revenge for the Israeli assassination of Sheikh Yassin. They spread flyers around the scene of where they killed the Blackwater guys. Some of the flyers were hung on the backs of trucks and some in some of the nearby shops. They had warned people that the attack was coming, so that's why the streets were relatively empty. And then when the Blackwater guys came through and they knew they were coming, they were ready for them. And so we can actually, at least in that time frame, you could argue fairly confidently that the entire situation of Fallujah, the spark that lit the fire, was actually lit by the Israeli military in Gaza on March 22nd. So yet another example, as you know, Scott, you've covered this on your show with myself and many other guests over the years, that when the Israeli military beats its wings in Gaza, the echoes go across the entire Middle East. And here is one very bloody example of how Israeli policy literally led to the lives of, some private security contractors for starters, but then hundreds of dead U.S. soldiers as a result of Israeli foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then can you talk about a little bit about the blowback from the, especially the second attack on Fallujah in November 2004 and the refugees and all that? Because, you know, it seemed like that was what really gave the suicide bomber resistance, rather than tribal sheiks trying to negotiate the upper hand in, from the Sunni point of view, was the, all the conflict that was generated from that. I mean, again, you can always go back to the you know what? History is going to always go back to the original sin of the invasion of March 03, like Bush's Woodrow Wilson or something. I mean, boy, did you not have to do that, stupid, to set all these horrible dominoes falling and knocking each other over and leading to all of this conflict. We can always go back to that. But specifically, he also did not have to send the Marines into Fallujah the way he did. He was just proving what a tough guy he was. In fact, remember General Sanchez reproduced Bush's little pep talk. This is a moment, and so we have to bomb them and go save democracy and whatever. He told the generals to go in there and just blast the hell out of everything to prove that we are the winners here. And then what happened, Dar?
That's exactly right, Scott. I mean, that whole time period was, it was really insane. I mean, it was a lesson in hubris. I mean, again, as you were going through some of this earlier, you know, it was just before the, when the U.S. election happened in 2004, already the decision had been made to invade Fallujah. Of course, not everybody on the ground was aware of that, least of all the people on the negotiating team in the city of Fallujah. Mohammed al-Daraji, he's actually one of the doctors I quoted in the article I wrote last week about what's going on in Fallujah, because he helped found an NGO, an aid NGO operating in the city. He was actually on the negotiating team of leaders in the city, tribal sheikhs, doctors, et cetera, aid workers, who were in negotiations with people in the U.S. military, and they thought they were good faith negotiations. They still thought and hoped that there was a way to ward off this massive siege. They knew that it would result in hundreds, if not thousands, of casualties, which it did, mostly civilians. And so up until the last minute, they were negotiating in good faith and still thinking maybe we were going to be able to avert this. And, of course, the on-the-ground leaders of the U.S. military were hoping it could be averted for obvious reasons. But then, of course, the election happened, and then they gave it a few days. And then on November 8th, out of nowhere, which surprised everybody in the negotiations, at least on the Iraqi side, Iyad Alawi, the former CIA asset, who was at the time the interim prime minister of Iraq, who the U.S. had put in place conveniently, said, okay, I am giving the green light for the siege, as though he had any power to instruct the U.S. military what to do. So we, of course, know exactly where that order came from. You just had touched on it and by playing the nice early recording to remind us all of the pleasant former President Bush of where that order came from. So the city was sieged. Daraji's NGO estimated upwards of 5,000 casualties, the majority of them civilians. And then as a result, yeah, we had 300,000-plus refugees, many of whom to date have never been able to go back home, either because of
Let me ask you, can you stay another 10 minutes, Dar? I hate to just cut you off here for the break, but I got to take it. Can you stay another 10?
Sure thing.
Okay, great. It's Dar Jamail, everybody. Truthout.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. I'm on the phone with Dar Jamail. I really should have given him a better introduction at the beginning of this thing. Dar reported on the Iraq War from at least nearly the beginning, for years and years. from Iraq as an unembedded reporter, and he wrote at least a couple of books about it. And I'm sorry, I don't remember your whole bio off the top of my head anymore, bud, but I can tell you that this guy, he was there. He's not just telling you what he read about Iraq or what he learned from talking to somebody who was there like me. He was there. He's the guy I was talking to who I learned this stuff from in the first place. And so, you know, I'm really happy to have the opportunity to give him a chance to talk to you guys today. So I do want to get back to current events and, you know, whether there's any hope of peace here, or we're just going to have an unending Sunni-Shia Arab civil war from now on because of George Bush or what. But first of all, you were telling the history of the blowback from that, I guess, Siege 2 of Fallujah in November 04, especially there, Dar.
Yeah, so where we left off is that, you know, we had several hundred thousand people displaced from that siege who still haven't gone home. And this is a province, Anbar province, where Fallujah is, the large western province. And this is where the brunt of the resistance has come from against the U.S. military when the occupation was ongoing. And then now against the Maliki regime, because we have once again, a government set up where there's a large portion of the population, and in this case now it's the minority Sunnis, who really don't have adequate representation in the government. The Shia, it's a government basically set up to fail, and the U.S. designed it and put it there and left it there in place, set it up along sectarian lines, knowing that this was going to happen. And you know, we're looking now at a situation in Iraq where it's such a bloodbath. It's so unstable, and there's really no end in sight as far as what is a solution, what's in reality, in the geopolitical reality of the situation, what's really going to need to happen. There's no chance for it to happen because, again, we can trace so much of this back to the U.S. And so much of the things that you and I, Scott, talked about over the years, like back in 2004 when they brought in John Negroponte to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Negroponte,
the El Salvador option.
Exactly, who brought in retired Colonel James Steele to set up death squads in Iraq, again, sectarian-based death squads, pulling them from the Mahdi Army and the Badr Brigades, you know, the two bigger, more well-armed and funded Shia militias, and then sending them out literally to hunt Sunnis. So all these sectarian-based policies, the, you know, the tit-for-tat killings along sectarian lines, the political lines drawn, again, along sectarian lines, and this is what's created the conditions for what is current present-day Iraq, where there's, of course, you know, goes without saying, nothing like democracy, nothing like equal representation and any kind of a real power balance within the government. You have literally Maliki, who's come in, has created his own secret service, his own private militias, his own torture dungeons, and is basically running the government as such, as a Shia Saddam, as a Shia dictator. And so essentially the U.S., they switched horses. You know, Saddam wasn't playing ball the way they wanted him to play ball anymore. After playing ball with him quite happily for a couple of decades, so they went in, invaded the country, replaced them, went through a couple of other previous guys who had dictator potential, Alawi being one of them, and then settling, well, you know, we'll go with Maliki. He seems to be playing ball with us. And so that's what we have. We've got them now riding the Maliki horse. They've already donated $20 billion in arms and training, as I said earlier. And now we have the bloodbath. That's, you know, in general why we have the bloodbath that we do in Iraq today. And really, unfortunately, the great tragedy is I really don't see a solution. I mean, not one that would actually occur in practicality on the ground. There's no solution in sight. The U.S. is absolutely not going to get directly involved again. There's no way that's going to happen. And so instead, they're just going to keep funneling in arms, and there's no indication that they're going to stop doing that into Maliki while he's carrying out these draconian military missions against people in Al-Anbar and on a smaller scale around parts of Baghdad.
Right. Well, you know what's funny too, man, if you go back and think about it, if we had just cut and run back in 2004, I mean, nobody knows exactly what would have happened, but the Shiite parties, the United Iraqi Alliance, the Dawa, the Skiri, and Sadr, that alliance, they would have had so much more incentive to negotiate with the Sunnis and come to some kind of settlement without us there. But as long as they had us, it was really, that was the success of the surge, if it was anything, was finishing up the complete sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, or not complete, but it's about an 85 or 90% Shiite Arab city now, because they were able to get the U.S. infantry and the U.S. Marine Corps to fight that war for them. But if, and remember, all the excuses were, no, we can't cut and run now because the violence will get worse. The violence will get worse. But if we left then, all of the, well, there would have been much more incentive for the Shiites to compromise. Now, since the Americans helped them take the capital city and everything, now they can just tell the Sunnis, screw off. We don't have to share any of the oil money with you. We don't have to share any of the resources with you. We don't have to do anything for you. We already won. You already lost. So what are you going to do about it? And that's where they're at now. So I'm not saying it would have been perfect. Never again, never should have invaded at all. But, you know, just thinking back on all of the bogus arguments and catchphrases and slogans of the war party that kept us in that war all those years, how fake they all were, how many people knew better back then. Even Sauder wanted in 04 to say, to join an alliance with the insurgent tribes in Fallujah and say, let's have a nationalist Arab allied government against the Iranians and the Americans both. And, of course, the Americans vetoed that and ended up turning over the South to the Iranians and getting their asses kicked out back in 2011.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think that it's a solid argument that if the U.S. had withdrawn, then Iraq would definitely be in better shape today, because it would have been a more level playing field politically, and all sides would have really had no choice to try to work things out more diplomatically, as opposed to now. You know, just it really did play out in large part as you described. The U.S. stayed in there, continued the power imbalance, favoring Maliki and his cohort, and so now there's this massive imbalance. And you know, it's really amazing, because I mean, I was in Fallujah a year ago this month. And I remember I went to one of these Friday demonstrations, and I interviewed one of the leading sheikhs of that demonstration on that day, a guy named Sheikh Khalid Hamoud al-Jumaili. Jumaili tribe very, very strong in Fallujah. And he said, look, what Maliki's doing is wrong. They're dividing us. He's kidnapping us. He's displacing us. We're making these demands, basically, which is just to have our basic core human rights respected. We've been making these demands peacefully for months, and what's he do? He keeps coming in, and now he's starting to kill us when we're having nonviolent protests on a highway for 2 hours a week, and they're not being met. And this was as far back as last March. The protests I went to, they were calling it Last Chance Friday, because they were saying, look, this is it. If they don't meet our demands now, then I don't know. We might have to start fighting. And that's what he told me on that day. Well, they went another 9 months almost without starting to fight back against the Maliki army. It's amazing that they stayed peaceful for that long. I think it's a testament to their intentions, that they really didn't want things to devolve into this level of violence. But then push came to shove, and you'd only kill so many dozens of protesters, and eventually the sheikhs aren't going to be able to control the fighters under them, and then you have a new wave of resistance against the government, and then that's what we're looking at now. They can't punch into Fallujah because the fighting is too fierce, so they just surround it and shell it and keep tightening the noose around what supplies they let into the city, medical supplies or otherwise, and that's what we have now. So we do. We have you know, what's devolved into essentially a civil war, largely along sectarian lines. And as we just talked about, you can trace the cause of this right back to the exploiting the sectarian lines and the very sectarian, the biased sectarian policies of the U.S. military and government while the occupation was going on. But this was set up, I think, clearly by design, just like the government in Lebanon is set up, to where there's always going to be a massive power imbalance, and that way no one's ever going to really be able to get, we're not going to have a truly representative, stable government, and that's what we have in Iraq, and that's why you know, and with short, massive, massive, radical changes on the ground, starting with getting rid of Maliki and his regime and having some real elections. Because you know, remember, he lost the last election against Yed Lowy, where he literally didn't even win the majority of the votes, and here he sits as prime minister.
Right. Which is amazing, because Alawi, as you said, he was the former CIA truck bomber sock puppet in 2004, and people even preferred him to Maliki by then, but Maliki was able to retain power. Now, part of that, then, though, also was that in January of 2004, the Ayatollah Sistani said, we want one man, one vote, none of this Paul Bremer-designed caucus system. And he said, if you're a Shiite and you believe in God, I want you to go outside and demand one man, one vote. So all the Shiites went outside and said, you want to start this war over again, Bush? And he said no. And so at that point, you know, the best they could do was the disaster to come.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And it was amazing because I was in Baghdad when that happened, and he called for those demonstrations, and they were the single biggest demonstrations I have ever witnessed in my life. I mean, it was as though, at that time, Baghdad wasn't as predominantly Shia as it is now, but even then, there were well over a million people. I mean, the entire capital city was shut down. There were just masses of people in the streets, any direction you looked. And all the Bush administration could do is have the military fly a bunch of helicopters around, taking pictures of them and talking on their walkie-talkies, which we were listening in on at the time. And that's all they could do. And they knew at that point, yeah, I think we better back down. I don't think we have enough troops on the ground to deal with this if we piss Sistani off, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. I mean, remember, David Wimser and Richard Pearl thought they were going to get a Hashemite sock puppet king like in Jordan, or if not that, maybe Ahmed Chalabi to be loyal and install an AEI policy the whole time. That whole fantasy fell apart, I think, on day two of the invasion, but the chaos, you know, rages on. Now, where else can we find you? You're still at DarjamilIraq.com or what?
The website's gone through some iterations. It's darjamail.net.
Okay, great.
I am reporting now full-time with Truth Out, so I do intend to continue writing more stories on what's happening in Iraq.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you back, Dar. Thank you so much for your time.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Take care.
All right, everybody. That is Dar Jamail, darjamail.net, and now he is writing for Truth Out. Truthout.org. This one is called Iraqi Government Killing Civilians in Fallujah. Sad story as the consequences of America's war continue. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.